Climate change is happening so fast, we can't just cut emissions. We also have to adapt to the inevitable.
When I started to really read that climate atmosphere literature, I realized that it was important for us to advance in our actions around climate change and not exclude adaptation. They were really like two strands of the double helix. They needed to work together.
That's ecologist Amy Seidel. We talked to her about her hopeful vision of surviving and even thriving in a warmer world. And are you prepared for disaster?
This is like insurance. People buy car insurance, and nobody says, gee, I want to get in a head-on collision today. They say, no, you know, you buy the insurance, and you hope to God you never need it. And the preparedness and making both short and long-term preparations is like that. If that day comes, a few $100 spent on some emergency supplies will be worth their weight in gold.
That's Matthew Stein. We talked to him about when disaster strikes. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's just turned spring, but in many parts of the country, it already feels like summer. If it's in the 80s in March, what's it going to be like in August? If temperatures break summer records like they have this winter, crops will suffer and death rates may soar from heat stroke. And it's not just about the weather. The New York Times reports that 3.7 million Americans live within a few feet of high tide and risk being hit by more frequent coastal flooding because of sea level rise caused by global warming. In 2009, ecologist Amy Seidel came on our show to talk about her book, Early Spring. That book was about understanding climate change by examining the signs of a warming world. Her new book, Finding Higher Ground, is about adapting to those changes, telling stories of climate resiliency. For example, new strains of rice are being grown in Vermont, and architects are designing buildings that nurture their surrounding ecosystems. It's all part of a new consciousness of adaptation that works along with cutting greenhouse gas emissions, the ones that are causing the problem in the first place. And it's about hope. Amy Seidel has taught in the environmental programs at Middlebury College and the University of Vermont. I spoke with her about Finding Higher Ground in October of 2011. Well, Amy Seidel, welcome to Writer's Voice. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, some people say adaptation, if we focus on adaptation, then we're not going to do mitigation. How do you answer them?
You know, I begin the book by actually entering into that discourse. It's true, for a long time, or for the past decade, as the mitigative action and support has built for reducing carbon emissions across the world, people have been concerned that if we also talked about adaptation at the same time, there would be a false notion somehow conveyed that we could adapt to anything. And so we could go ahead with a fossil fuel-based economy and in the end be able to adapt to it. And I think what's changed and what's distinctly different now is, one, the weather, and two, atmospheric science that shows how long-lived climate change will be. So while it's absolutely paramount, really essential, to keep the mitigative pressure high and the work that Bill McKibben is doing with 350.org and others, we simultaneously have to really own and absorb the information that this is a long-lived event, that if we look at the climate change models, we see that even if we were to cease emissions suddenly, to automatically, immediately, right now, we would still see climate change into the year 3000. So when I started to really read that literature, that climate atmosphere literature, I realized that it was important for us to advance in our actions around climate change and not exclude adaptation because of this premise that it might sort of pull from the steam and urgency of mitigation, but that they were really like two strands of the double helix. They needed to work together, that the best adaptation strategies were ones that also mitigated climate change at the same time or reduced emissions. And so I have gone forward, and I think other people will move along with me to advance both a mitigative and adaptive strategy so that we feel, you know, quite persistent about the future and not fatalistic about one.
You talk about a number of different areas. You talk about energy. You talk about agriculture. How about in agriculture? Can you give an example of a strategy that's both adaptive and mitigative?
So, you know, here in Vermont, we have recently seen some really tremendous weather. And we're not alone here. We're also a very agricultural state, and we grow predominantly corn. We have lots of pasture, but our main crop is corn because we have lots of dairy cows that eat corn. Well, we had historic rains in April and May, far exceeding any other record of rain for those months. And we couldn't get the corn in. We couldn't plant it. It was five and six times before that corn seed took. Now, other people are experimenting with alternative agricultural products that would actually do well in wetter, warmer environments, like what Vermont will see. So by planting something like rice, which does well in flooded environments, can actually be very, very nutritional, and is been selected now to have a variety that grows here in Vermont and does very well, it becomes a very adapted strategy to grow as an agricultural product. But the other point is that it doesn't need a lot of fossil fuel input. So corn, if you look at the planting of corn, its harvesting, its processing, is very fossil fuel intensive, not only in its production, but in the inputs that go into growing corn. Well, that isn't true with alternative agricultural products like rice that are grown perhaps in a polyculture or permaculture setting where there are very few fossil fuel inputs. So rice in Vermont is an example of mitigating climate change because you're not using as much fossil fuel and being adapted to the effects of climate change because it actually likes the conditions that we're going to see more of.
Rice in Vermont. That's cool.
It is. I mean, and I appreciate when people hear that story and they're like, what? They're bewildered by the idea of rice in Vermont. We think of rice as California, Minnesota, if it's wild, and all of Asia, you know. But that kind of creative, innovative response to these radically changing conditions is a lot of what I'm speaking about in Finding Higher Ground.
Amy Seidel, you say in your new book, Finding Higher Ground, that adaptation is not just, let's say, biological or physical, it's cultural as well. And I think an illustration of that, you tell a story of the Norse people living in Greenland back during the Little Ice Age, back in another time of climate change. And you make a contrast between what happened to them and how the Inuit adapted. Tell us the story and the moral of the story.
I start down that thinking, not only with the Inuit and the Norse, but with other occasions in human history and civilization where some members, some humans, found ways to adapt to changing conditions and others did not. And that's really sort of the take-home is, how can we be as flexible as the communities that persisted in the past? And the Inuit is an example of a community that really persisted through these changes in the past. So we know that the Norse and Eric the Red and really colonists from Scandinavia, Denmark, and Finland predominantly came to Greenland, and they came during a time where the weather was warmer. We were in this sort of climate optimum of based on planetary issues, based on astronomical forces and not on human-induced climate change as we're seeing today. And they were able to set up shop for many generations, four, five, six generations there in Greenland. Well, as we saw changes in weather again during the Little Ice Age, it became apparent that the kind of agriculture they were living in, a pastoral dairy agriculture that they'd brought to Greenland, was not going to take them through. And yet they remained stuck in the cultural practices of doing things a certain way, waiting, for instance, for spring to come before they really start in on their agriculture and food gathering for the winter, maintaining a really strong need for goods and services coming from Europe and on the sort of motherships that would arrive to Greenland for them. And yet, right next door to these populations of Greenlanders coming from Europe were the Inuit, an ancient people who had lived in the Arctic for thousands and thousands of years, who, you know, had all kinds of innovation and came up with new innovation as the glaciers advanced onto the island, and actually did really, really well during that little ice age, even while the Viking populations began to go extinct and to die off. And so when we go back to the archaeological history of Greenland during the little ice age, we actually find these sort of what they call middens in archaeological research, these sort of trash heaps. And we find that the trash heaps of the Inuit are full of lots of nutritious foods they didn't actually have to eat, like the marrow of bones or the fat tissue on their seals. And yet the middens of the Viking people are scraped thin of their marrow, and the dogs have been eaten, and their cows have been eaten, and eventually everybody is gone. And so it's a very, it seems to me, a clear telling of the inability of a culture to look even next door to tools and practices and maybe even ideologies and values that would help them persist, rather than stay so constrained and unflexible and unadapted to these changing conditions at hand.
You're really giving an example of the difference between rigidity and resilience.
Exactly, and I think that word rigidity is perfect, you know, very, very rigid. And we can see that in our own lives, because I think adaptation is something, although not perhaps in the same depth of definition that I'm using it in this book, but we know in our own lives that when we're hit with a circumstance that really rocks our world, we can either sort of fight it and see no exit, and like you say, be rigid, or we can sort of advance into new territory where oftentimes we come out the other side a changed individual and perhaps better for it. And although that's a little simplistic, I think that it resonates for the individual, and it can be applied to this cultural notion, which is how are we going to change from something so embedded as living on fossil fuels to something entirely different, but that does not emit carbon. I mean, that's what we're up against.
We're talking with Amy Seidel about her new book, Finding Higher Ground, Adaptation in an Age of Warming. You also say that we should be looking beyond climate change in our adaptation strategies, that we have to enact strategies that are based on other or broader ecological goals, and no-regrets strategies. What are you talking about there?
Yeah, you know, I knew you were going to take me there here at some point during this interview, and I'm really happy we're already there, because we're talking today on October, 13th, and for the last couple of weeks there has been an occupation in Wall Street, in New York City on Wall Street, of people asking for change. And there's almost a frustration with people, I think, outside of the protest, which is, what kind of change? Be specific with us. We need to know what you want. And I think that for myself, looking in on that occupation and feeling a real strong relationship to what those individuals are saying, is that there are systemic problems afoot. And whether you look at them through an economic lens or an environmental lens or even a social lens of justice, they're all implicated. So we could stand back and look at climate change and say, and sometimes we need to, just to almost progress in our argument, that we can't burn fossil fuels any longer. There must be a moratorium on coal, for instance, in order to change this situation. At the same time, it's an indication or just one example of a whole array of planetary constraints that we're going to face here on planet Earth in the near term. We're going to need fresh water reserves for 9 billion people and foodstuffs for 9 billion people. We're going to need to really address the overconsumption of few individuals on this planet versus the real high needs of many, many more. There are lots of environmental issues that if we looked at them too specifically, we don't see the connectedness. But stepping out, we see that fossil fuel use is very closely tied to, you know, recessionary economics or other other sector of problem. And so I'm asking my readers in Finding Higher Ground to examine climate change, perhaps in a proximal sense, like how are we going to persist through this phenomenon? But then to think as largely and as systems-based as they can to say, when we address that problem, how might we meet the challenges of these other problems simultaneously? I think just as an example, using alternative energy is a good one. You know, some thinkers out there right now not only want to see more and more alternative energy because it keeps us from using coal, but in a world in which there are 2 billion people who don't have any electricity now at all, it leapfrogs them into a technology that has much fewer, you know, toxins and pollutants and impact than a fossil fuel industry. So there's a real way to bring those 2 billion into an energy, into some sort of energy use, as well as to address climate change at the same time.
That's a good example, but it can get thornier, you know, as one looks at other issues. For example, agriculture. You know, there are people, there are people, even progressive environmental organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, which has teamed up with Monsanto to promote the use of genetically modified organisms because they're concerned about feeding 9 billion people by the year 2050. Mm-hmm. And other people say, no, we need organic agriculture. And they counter and say, well, organic agriculture isn't going to feed 9 billion people. What's your opinion on this controversy?
Yeah. You know, I was just teaching, actually, about feeding 9 billion by mid-century or by 2075, whatever the UN prediction is for that population number. And there's some very interesting data, I think actually some data that really supports your latter point, which is, can organic agriculture feed the world? And going back, of course, we see what kind of unintended consequences the Green Revolution had for the planet. Certainly, climate change.
And explain what the Green Revolution.
Yeah, so the Green Revolution really began in the late 1940s, 1950s, in the post World War, Second World War America, where we began to use a lot of synthetic inputs and fossil fuel inputs to increase the yield capacity of our crops, and it worked. I mean, 2 to 3 times yields were not uncommon, and yet that agricultural system saw phenomenal amounts of chemicals. Well, you know, soon thereafter we had the production or the publication of Silent Spring, drawing attention to the unintended consequence in that case of herbicides and pesticide residues finding their way into the food chain. And then in time we had, you know, the evolution of organic agriculture, which is funny to say even evolution because it's a rethinking of an agricultural process that's really historic. But a woman named Catherine Bagley published a paper in 2007, I think it was, with that title that I mentioned, Can Organic Agriculture Feed the World? And she did this amazing global analysis looking at all of the ways in which, you know, crops are being produced right now and where. And, you know, 80% of agriculture in the world is actually organic and traditional and indigenous and doesn't have these high inputs. It's really an industrial agriculture that does, and although it creates a lot of food, it's not dominant as a practice, right? There are lots of alternative methodologies still in practice. And if you look at them closely, it turns out, and if we modeled them in places where industrial agriculture exists, we could, according to her global analysis, actually come up with this, you know, a similar amount of calories production every year, and replace actually our fossil fuel inputs, fertilizers in particular, with things like green manures, with leguminous crops that, fix nitrogen in the soil for us. So I think that you know, your point about genetic engineering and NGOs, environmental NGOs, feeling pretty desperate about the situation, or at least wanting to research the role of genetic engineering, is premature, I think, because we need to learn from the fact that these unintended consequences of chemical residue in our soils are really problematic for us. And the unintended consequences, I see it, from genetic engineering would be the release of genetic material in wild populations that we can't track. And so we've got to be very, very cautious about advancing these technologies when we don't know entirely how they're going to react and interact with, you know, natural and agricultural systems. Instead, data like Catherine Bagley shows us that old practices, traditional practices that are sustainable and productive, are a better way to move forward.
And could you clarify maybe the difference between GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and plant breeding? Because clearly, you know, you just mentioned before that there are strains of rice that are being developed that would do well in Vermont. So that's some kind of, you know, genetic modifications. And a lot of, you know, the companies that are behind GMOs are saying that they're going to be creating more drought-resistant rice, you know, in the areas which are going to see drought, which is probably most of the a huge swath of the middle band of the planet.
Right, right. Yeah, and there it's a real distinction. You know, we have been selecting varieties using what we call artificial selection by bringing different varieties, say, of wheat together, and then growing up those seeds in conditions that are either more dry or more wet. And if they do really well in dry conditions, then selecting for the individuals that had the highest yield in that dry environment, and so on across generations of plants, so that we could come up with these hardy varieties for drought. Now, that's what we call artificial selection. It's really the field of horticultural science. And it goes back, you know, it goes back to Gregor Mendel, you know, and others in the 1700s, probably even before that time, perhaps even inadvertently, that humans have moved from hunting and gathering into agriculture and wanted certain kinds of traits to persist in their gardens. But genetically modified agriculture or genetically modified organisms is a very, very different process. And that's the process of actually inserting foreign material, genetic material, into the genome of species of interest. So it could be a plant, it could be an animal, it could be a fish, and it could be a cross species. So you could take a gene from a fish that perhaps confers something around cold tolerance and put it into a tomato, or vice versa, tomato genes into fish genes. And this is kind of bizarre that we've been able to do it, but we have, kind of as an outgrowth of our understanding of genetics. And those of us who are concerned and very cautious about releasing these genetically modified organisms think, well, what if then that agricultural plot of wheat then crosses with a native species of wheat in our community? Well, now that native wheat species has a fish gene in it, which based on evolution could never, ever happen because fish and plants don't breed. And so it begins to really warp our realities around nature. And I think right now, I guess you see me hesitating because I think that I'm skeptical, highly, highly skeptical of genetically modified organisms, and yet I want to leave open the opportunity for them to prove me wrong. But right now, my feeling is that it is it's a very young science that, if moved too quickly to perhaps solve a problem, will almost surely have these unintended consequences.
Mm. I mean, it may not matter that much if there's a fish gene in corn, but it, it may. Another issue is, you know, kind of goes to the heart of what you talk about in terms of the culture, because so much of the GMOs are really caught up with the idea of intellectual property and patenting nature and restricting access. And it seems that we're going to have to be able to spread access to new sustainable practices as fast as possible if we're going to survive.
Yeah, you know, it's for on so many levels, it just feels, it feels unjust, it feels proprietary, it feels, as you say, sort of the opposite of an open source understanding of how does a global society work together to feed people versus how do corporations give us patented products that we then plant, right? And so the notion of stewardship is almost entirely lost, and it feels corporatized, which again, going back to sort of the occupation movement, is a reaction that many of us are having right now, not only to what's happening with banking industry or student debt, but why we can't get further in changing culture right now, transitioning culture to be one that reflects better stewardship and more sustainable outcomes for a global society. And I think that, you know, in essence, is why, you know, somebody like Bill McKibben has now joined with the occupation movement and in support, because he too, on up, you know, his own political action feels repeatedly thwarted by a corporatized political system that won't let his voice in, even though he's got lots and lots and lots of supporters and Americans saying, this is what we want.
Yeah, I was down there. Well, I've been down a number of times, but I was down at Zuccotti Park, or as I like to call it by its old name, Liberty Park.
Yeah.
last week, and there was a great sign there that said, "Are we really going to let these greedy fools run our planet?"
That's right. Pretty succinct. You know, pretty succinct. And it's not that we haven't, you know, I mean that by the voice of individuals who see the differences, right? Who feel the weather, who see the changes, who feel hamstrung by what they can do. So we can work personally, we can work in our communities as far as we can, but then we need different technologies, we need different incentives, we need leadership that also sees the weather and sees these changes and says, aha, what we're going to do then is create an incentive for electric-based transportation, or for more incentive to put solar on your rooftop, or we're going to respond to Fukushima in Japan the way the Germans and the Japanese and others have, and really take a very close look at nuclear and rule it out as a sustainable, certainly not a clean source of energy in the future. So it's the response of leadership right now to the growing evidence of systemic problems. And many people feel like that response isn't there because it's a moneyed interest that gains all attention. And people are fed up with that and frustrated on many different accounts, you know?
Yeah. Now, you talk about that great old American value, self-reliance. If you could give us maybe just one example of a way that people are already practicing self-reliance, tell us the need for self-reliance, and how can this be scaled up?
Yeah, I do. I have a chapter where I talk about self-reliance and self-sufficiency, and I think that I'll just kind of go back to what I was just saying around, you know, at the personal level, many of us feel that we see these signals and we also feel complicit. You know, for instance, I'm looking out my window and I have a car. You know, I drive into town. I drive to a bus stop where I catch a bus or I take my children to school. Many, many, many of us live that way. And yet it doesn't feel right to be driving and using gasoline. Even in driving the most efficient car on the market, it doesn't feel right given what we know, right? And so that feeling of what I think of as a kind of chronic complicity, it weighs on many of us. And one of the responses to that feeling of complicity and the need to breach with these old practices has been self-reliance. And food has been the most accessible sector or sphere of being self-reliant. So I look outside right now and I see my own gardens and a real interest in growing as much food as I can for myself and my family, and or to trade that food, to grow a lot here and then to trade it with my neighbor who happens to have a dairy cow or with other neighbors who happen to be sugaring in this part of Vermont where I live. And what it does then is it begins to engender a kind of resilience and a buffering capacity, a feeling like I've got some measure of security in an uncertain world. But I've also lightened that footprint because I feel weighted by this complicity. So I'm kind of balancing what I can do in my own life against what I'm kind of locked into because of this normative culture. And it's really kind of fascinating because if you look at the history of self-reliance, these are the same reactions that Thoreau had when he went to Walden and that Emerson talks about, you know, among the transcendentalists, that Leopold speaks about, Aldo Leopold, one of the fathers of environmental writing and the need for an environmental ethic. So the idea of finding ways to live simply, to feel that you have the skills to meet some basic needs that you have, I think are really appropriate right now in a very highly technological 21st century because they lift that weight of complicity and they let us kind of wait in the wings until different practices and different technologies are so prevalent that perhaps we don't have to feel the need for kind of 19th century approaches in our lives.
Well, there is some hope, I think, and that's what we're getting from your book, Finding Higher Ground, Adaptation in the Age of Warming. Thanks so much, Amy Seidel. This is a hopeful book, and we need some hope in this time.
It is a hopeful time. It can be one, and you know, one of the things that we've seen here in Vermont and the Northeast saw was Hurricane Irene, right? That tropical storm that landed for us 5 inches of rain in one day. And what we saw in response to that disaster was what other people in the world see post-disaster. It's a crack, really. It's a crack, a disruption in, you know, social hierarchy, in sort of business as usual, and through that crack comes not only hopefulness, but great communitarian quality of the human being. You know, people dropping everything and going and helping for days and days and days. You know, people putting others first. People not caring about exchange of money for things. People just giving things away. People rescuing others. Their pets, their children, their needs are being met just because we're cohabiting in a place together. And I think that although these were unusual circumstances, that crack gives us great insight into what it is we want to build, right? What it is we want to, how it is we want to live differently. And that's great. That's greatly hopeful because we realize that we have the capacity. It's just kind of waiting in the wings for good leadership and perhaps better times or the right times.
Amy Seidel, thanks so much for talking with us about Finding Higher Ground.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment today, we heard from author Amy Seidel about adapting to a warming world. That's a project for decades, if not generations. Now we turn to surviving disasters, which bid fair to become more frequent as the planet heats up. And as we saw in Fukushima last year, when a tsunami caused nuclear meltdowns, natural disasters can lead to human-caused ones. My next guest, engineer, designer, and green builder Matthew Stein, wants you to be prepared. We spoke to him several years ago about his book, When Technology Fails, a guide to surviving what he calls the long emergency, one created by the convergence of peak oil, climate change, and the depletion of all kinds of resources from overpopulation. Stein's new book, When Disaster Strikes, will help you get through the short and medium term.
So the first four chapters in the new book covers general supplies and preparations. These are your short-term survival kits, your food storage, self-reliance in the home. There's a really excellent all-new chapter about making your home better prepared to deal with things like backup power systems, heat and light, food storage in the home, that kind of thing. Then the second part of the book covers essential skills, tools, techniques, and tips. For instance, a chapter on first aid has a chapter on emergency survival. Then it's got a brand new chapter on personal protection and self-defense. Life in crises is often messy. You know, you hope that you never need the information in these books, but it's the kind of information that if your life does get messy and you happen to be in a crisis situation or disaster, then you'll thank God that you've taken some time to follow some of the guidance within the book. And then there's a chapter on staying healthy in a pandemic when medical facilities are unavailable. Then there's a chapter on water purification and storage, and a brand new chapter on communications, things like shortwave radios, CB radios, scanners, police scanners, emergency weather radios, things like that. What sort of things should you have on hand, and what could you count on in terms of communication in a situation where the grid is down and things have kind of fallen apart for a while? Then the last third of the book covers detailed instructions and expert guidance pertaining to very specific disasters, such as fires, earthquakes, hurricanes and floods, coping with severe winter weather without heat or power, and solar storms and EMP. That's a genuine threat that some people are quite concerned of for very good reason, and most of us are just kind of going along with our daily life and not even thinking about it, but they're very real things.
Could you say what that is for those of our listeners who may not know that?
Throughout history, and scientifically, it looks like about every 70 years on the average, the planet Earth gets struck by a super solar storm. And what that is the sun has these big sunspots, and there's something called a coronal mass ejection, where the sun kind of burps, and you get this big, giant hunk of the sun, a plasma of highly charged particles just sort of blasting out into space at very high speeds. And they reach the Earth anywhere between 8 hours' time and 5 or 6 days later. And most of the time, these burps just kind of miss the Earth. And sometimes they hit the Earth, and we get beautiful display of northern lights at night. And every 70 years or so, a really bad one hits the Earth, and the sky lights up for nights at a time. And it looks almost daylight, and you might have blood-red sky in Haiti or Florida. I mean, normally northern lights are places like British Columbia and Maine and Vermont. And so when these super solar storms hit, it causes an electromagnetic storm all over the planet. And the last time a really big one like this hit was 1921. There was no microelectronics. There was no internet. There was no computer. There was no massive electronic grid. So basically, individual cities might be electrified, and you had some telegraph stations burned down, and you had some actual power plants burned down because this magnetic storm caused such giant voltage and current spikes to get induced in the power lines that it actually cooked the power generating stations. They caught on fire and burned down. But in those days, it's like the world was kind of used to getting by without electricity. And so you kind of had a big disruption, and things didn't work well for a few days, and no big deal. But today's world's very different. So if a storm hit us like 1921, it would destroy these huge multi-million-dollar transformers all over most of the northern and southern hemispheres, except for perhaps the the tropical latitudes, where the Earth's magnetic field keeps the effects are focused closer to the poles, and so the tropical latitudes are kind of saved by that. And so if it happened today, it would mean the end of the Internet for possibly years.
Wow.
The grid down for probably years.
Why would it take years?
Here's why. This is something that the scientists and engineers know is a huge problem. It's not a question of if it will happen. It's a question of when the roll of the dice comes up and it does happen. When the solar storm hits, every long run of wire, except for like the tropical latitudes, will act like a giant antenna. And you'll have thousands of volts and thousands of amps of current induced by this solar storm under these big runs of wire. And the big runs of wire are like our communication wires and our grid wires that run power all over the place. They'll act like a giant antenna. All hooked into the grid, they have these huge power transformers at each of the major power generating stations. And these transformers cost over $1 million apiece and are custom-made, custom-designed, custom-built for each location. And they no longer make them in this country, though I believe there's a new plant coming up online soon that will be able to make them. But the world capacity to manufacture these things is roughly less than 100 of these a year. Now, it used to be that there was about a one-year waiting list to get one of these made. And now with China and India electrifying at such a rapid rate, they basically sucked up the world's production capacity of these transformers. So now there's like a three-year waiting list to get one. Well, if one of these transformers goes down, like happened in a solar storm that was one-tenth the size of the 1921 storm, in 1989, a solar storm hit that, again, is 10% as strong, one-tenth as strong as the 1921 storm. And the 1921 storm was roughly 50% weaker than the two back-to-back giant storms in 1859 called the Carrington event. So I'm those Carrington event ones apparently kind of happen every 500 years or more, so I'm not as worried about one that size. But the one in 1921 apparently, scientists say, happens roughly every 60, 70 years, so we're about 20 years overdue for the next one. And this size event, then, they're estimating in the United States alone would fry 350 of these major power transformers. That's an estimate. Now, if the world capacity, when the world's working well, is 100 a year maximum, and 350 go down in North America and, say, a couple thousand over the planet, plus probably most, unless it's a plant in India, then chances are the plant that makes these power transformers, well, most of those plants will be disabled too and grid down. So here you'll have a situation where, you know, we built this massive electronic grid over the last 100 years, and it's become quite vulnerable to these kinds of storms, but because they happen so rarely, no one's really planned on or counted on them happening, because the last time they happened, the grid was not vulnerable. It was primitive technology. It didn't have microelectronics, didn't have these massive transformers, didn't have the massive runs of power lines. So it's much more susceptible and much more vulnerable now, and we're only now realizing how vulnerable it is, and they're talking about protecting it, but they actually haven't done anything to protect it. They've just, other than talk about it and study the problem.
What do you recommend? I mean, how can we protect against something like this electromagnetic pulse solar storm catastrophe?
Well, your best bet in preparing is to have both short-term emergency preparedness kit, like a 72-hour survival kit, but and naturally having more food and supplies to last a week or a month or more on hand. And this is something where you have to kind of weigh your financial means and your level of concern and paranoia. And also, I teach people to get in touch with an inner compass, an intuitional guidance from within. And because you may be fine. I mean, for instance, for the last 10 years, I've talked about food storage, but I haven't kept more than a month of supplied food on hand.
Oh, really?
And because intuitionally, I never felt like I really needed it. But now I'm building up to a year's supply of food on hand.
Wow.
Because I'm feeling that there's something really serious around the corner, and it's going to disrupt the way the world as we know it quite significantly.
You know, I kind of wanted to start by asking you about the short term, but we're talking here about the long term, and you talk about expense. I mean, it's a huge expense to put food by for a year, because you have to have a way to store that's going to keep it from going bad. Mm-hmm. So that's expensive as well. You know, what do you recommend for families that are already cash-strapped?
Well, for families that are already cash-strapped, then you need to accept that you're going to do what you can in the long run, and it's going to have to be the bulk grains and you know, seeds and beans and grains stored in bulk that's quite cheap. And you can start, like, grinding your own grain to make bread. If you're cash-strapped, you can start saying, okay, I'm going to buy sort of, I'm going to cook from scratch, and I'm going to buy things more in bulk. And that way, I'll eat healthier and better on a daily basis, and I'll be able to start each month putting away a little bit for in case. And this is like insurance. You know, people buy car insurance, and nobody says, gee, I want to get in a head-on collision today. They say no. You know, you buy the insurance, and you hope to God you never need it. And if that day comes and somebody's texting on their phone and runs the stop sign and slams into you, or you skitter on some ice and do no fault to anybody, and you wreck, then you thank God you have the insurance. And the preparedness and making both short and long-term preparations is like that. You know, you pray to God, and you hope that you never need it. If that day comes, then a few $100 spent on some emergency supplies and preparations and a few hours of time will be worth their weight in gold, and you'll thank God that you actually had the foresight to put some of these stores aside for yourself and your family. And you know, you can't plan for every possible scenario, but you try to plan for the more likely ones. And my book helps people to plan for these different potential things, and it also provides very specific strategies. So if you all of a sudden find that you're in the middle of one of these events, like, heaven forbid, an EMP or solar storm has collapsed the grid for an unknown period of time, or there's been a nuclear meltdown, and actually in the event of a big solar storm, our power plants run out of backup fuel generators to keep the reactors cooling, the nuclear reactors, after a week's time, they'll be out of fuel, and it takes a year to decommission a reactor. So if the backup generators are still functioning, and in Fukushima's case, they were functioning until the tsunami wave hit them, then they'll keep the reactor cool. But as soon as they stop functioning, then even when the reactor goes into emergency shutdown, which they're designed to do, it takes a year of continuous cooling to prevent them from melting down and blowing their containment vessel. So in Fukushima's case, they ran out of coolant when the tsunami hit the backup generators, and the grid was obviously down from the massive earthquake. But then the generators kicked in until the tsunami disabled them. But in the case of a massive grid failure, a week later they'll run out of backup fuel. And the government's promised that in the event of a serious catastrophe like that, they'll make sure that each and every one of the 104 reactors in America will receive their diesel fuel tanks like clockwork, and for the next year until they're fully cooled down and decommissioned. But, you know, things didn't work very well after Hurricane Katrina, so
yeah.
It's kind of hard to imagine in a grid-down super solar storm situation that they'll keep good on that.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with disaster preparedness expert Matthew Stein about his latest guide to survival, When Disaster Strikes. We have already this year seen some pretty fierce storms. We had a very early storm in October that just wiped out people in Connecticut and parts of New Jersey and Massachusetts for a week to 10 days, maybe sometimes even longer. How can people prepare for a winter storm where they could be losing power for a long amount of time and it's cold out there?
Right. Well, that is very well covered in my book, When Disaster Strikes. And actually, the longer-term scenarios we were talking about before, if you want to really be prepared for long-term shutdowns, then you need the big book, the When Technology Fails. But When Disaster Strikes covers extremely well situations like you're talking about, which are very probable. I mean, we've seen the hurricanes and the unusual earthquakes in the East Coast and this killer storm that hit early and knocked trees down everywhere. So what you do in that case is I talk about backup sources of heat and power in my book, and also how to drain your plumbing and winterize your plumbing. Because if it's, you know, your storm hit in October, right? A freak early storm, but
yeah,
it's still, it was cold outside, but it's not like it was 10 degrees outside. I mean, so it was uncomfortable and inconvenient, but you weren't going to burst all the pipes in your house and freeze all your plumbing. And if you had a long-term, like, multi-day blackout in the middle of winter and during a cold snap where it was 10 degrees or zero or, you know, or 15 degrees outside or 10 below, then you're going to see a situation where without a backup source of heat and power on your house, that you'll start freezing your pipes, you'll burst all the pipes, all your plumbing fixtures in your house will burst, unless you know how to drain and winterize your plumbing. And so I give very specific instructions and diagrams on that in the book.
But how are you going to stay warm?
Well, as far as staying warm, so there's a whole variety of things. I mean, if you have a backup source of heat, then obviously you stay warm with your wood stove or a kerosene stove or a natural gas or propane backup heater. And in those situations, you've got to be extremely careful about carbon monoxide poisoning, unless it's got a chimney to the outside of the house. You know, people, the classic killer is where people are freezing in climates that are kind of southerly and not normally that cold, and they bring a charcoal brazier, you know, charcoal grill into the room and go to sleep and never wake up because they don't leave the windows open open an inch or two for ventilation, and carbon monoxide is a tasteless and odorless poisonous gas, and it's simply, you know, you go to sleep and you don't wake up if you get, or maybe you get a severe headache and you're lucky and you realize what's going on, you get outside and you get some medical attention. But if you say you don't have a backup source of heat and say you powers out for a long time, then you can make a little tent, like a fort in your living room, like little kids do, where you basically take some blankets and quilts over furniture, and you can kind of hang out in a small area, and your body heat and a candle or two, if you've got them. But your body heat actually puts out about the same as 10 candles. It's hard to believe, but it's true. Then you'll be heating a much smaller insulated area, and you'll be able to stay more comfortable and warm. And so I certainly talk about having enough backup quilts and clothing on hand that you can be at least moderately comfortable and not freeze in the event that the inside of your house gets as cold as the outside does. And if you don't have a modern solar home that's well insulated, then your house will cool to close to the temperature of the outside after a day or two without a backup source of heat. So,
yeah, that's scary. So now, for those of our listeners who maybe, well, you know, earthquake zones are going farther than the West Coast. We've had a few on the East Coast here, and I think we're a lot less prepared for them. What are some things that people might do in the case of an earthquake? How can they prepare for that?
Well, you want to prepare ahead of time by having a really good, it's called a 72-hour survival kit or grab-and-go or go-bag cookout kit.
Tell us about that. How do we put one together? I was surprised you actually suggest putting it in one of those kind of big plastic bins that you can buy for, like, you know, $12 at your local store.
Yeah, I suggest that you have both a backpack, and I like the backcountry-style ones. And on my website, wentechfails.com, I have links to buy. I have an article totally free telling you all the items I recommend in your grab-and-go kit. So we'll talk about some key items here, but there's like 25, so we won't have time to talk about all of them. And that's under articles at wentechfails.com. But also there's a new article called Building the Ultimate Survival Kit, and that has specific links to specific products that I can recommend. Naturally, there'll be lots more out there, similar stuff, but these are the ones that I know are good and I recommend. And so I like to have items in my grab-and-go kit, some big bulky items that I would never put on my backpack in case I had to evacuate by foot, those big bulky items go into a nice big blue tub, the plastic tubs at Home Depot or Lowe's or wherever you want to get them. And those, if I have the luxury, if I have to leave my home but I have the luxury of being able to use my car, then the big blue tub of stuff goes in the car. Now, if I don't have the luxury of being able to use my car, and you know, when you see a picture of disasters, what do you usually see? You see people walking down the road. They're usually hungry and thirsty, and sometimes they're hurt, and sometimes they're sick, and often they're cold and wet. And so I also have a very comfortable backpack capable of carrying a large load that if I need to evacuate on foot, because in an earthquake, where I live, I'm both in earthquake and wildfire country, so say an earthquake happened in the summer, if it was a bad one, it would break all the water lines and the gas lines, and fires would probably break out. They usually do from hot water heaters jumping over and things like that, and or power lines shorting out when a line falls down. And so you have a combination of no water to fight fires with and fires breaking out and bridges being down. So your car may not get you very far, and you may have to evacuate on foot to get out of the way, you know, cross the river and get out of the way of that fire. So it's a possibility. And like I said, this is insurance. You hope you never need it. But I cover myself with the backcountry gear that I can evacuate on foot if necessary, and the blue tub of bulkier stuff that I'd love to have in my car if I have the luxury of evacuating by car. Some of the items in there that are critical is a water filter is kind of number one, because for a family of four for 3 days, which isn't a very long period of time, in Kobe, Japan, it was 9 days before a lot of people got relief food and water. So a family of four for 3 days, you'd go through about 100 pounds of water to supply you and your family for 3 days. So you couldn't carry that in your back. So the ability to have a good backcountry filter, like an MSR Katadyn brand filter with a pump-type backcountry filter, I could go to any duck pond or ditch in the city, and I could put that filter into the scummy water that I would hate to have to drink from, and pump it, and in a minute, I've got a water bottle full of clear, safe, good-tasting drinking water out of that scummy green ditch water. Then I also have, naturally, a first aid kit, and I've got a big, honkin', extensive first aid kit that goes in my blue tubs that I would take with me if I could, and then I've got a little fits-in-the-palm-of-my-hand first aid kit along with a stretchy ACE bandage to wrap up sprains and wounds, and some inch-and-a-half cloth adhesive first aid tape. Those would all go in my backpack, you know, if I had to evacuate by foot. Plus, I have like a big Berkey gravity-fed water filter that is nice and easy. It's kind of like looks kind of like a coffee maker, and it stands, you know, it's about 10 inches in diameter, stands about a foot and a half tall, and you can just fill the whole top with water, and then gravity will feed through the filters and fill up the bottom. And so if you've got a bunch of people and you're hanging out and you need to purify some water, it's a great way to do it. But it's way too big to go in my backpack. So my backpack gets a nice little, fits in the palm of my hand, what weighs about a pound, backcountry water filter. So there's kind of different things. That's why I have the blue tub and the backpack.
Matthew Stein's book is When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide for Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival. Stein is an engineer, designer, and green builder. He lives and writes in the High Sierra Mountains of California. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his website, which has loads of information on disaster preparedness. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.